We have been in Jeremiah now for a number of Sundays, and today we are in Jeremiah chapter, well, really it's a little bit hard to say. The text is from chapters 7 to 10 and 26. And since we don't have a missions report, I should have ample time to cover all of that. But I'm a little bit nervous this morning. Our text is from Jeremiah 7 to 10. But what we read in chapter 7 to 10, sermons, temple sermons of Jeremiah, oracles they are sometimes called, are also repeated in chapter, or a shorter version of it, appears in chapter 26. And if I go to chapter 26, my Bible has the heading, Jeremiah Threatened with Death. And I'm looking at that exit door there, and maybe I can get out before my life is taken after this. This was Jeremiah's dilemma. And so let's read chapter 26, verses 1 to 9. Early in the reign of Jehoiakim, son of Josiah, king of Judah, this word came from the Lord. This is what the Lord says: stand in the courtyard of the Lord's house and speak to all the people of the towns of Judah who come to worship in the house of the Lord. Tell them everything I command you. Do not omit a word. Perhaps they will listen, and each will turn from his evil way. Then I will relent and not bring on them the disaster I was planning because of the evil they have done. Say to them, this is what the Lord says: if you do not listen to me and follow my law, which I have set before you, if you do not listen to the words of my servants, the prophets, whom I have sent to you again and again, though you have not listened, then I will make this house like Shiloh, and this city an object of cursing among all the nations of the earth. The priests, the prophets, and all the people heard Jeremiah speak these words in the house of the Lord, but as soon as Jeremiah finished telling all the people everything the Lord had commanded him to say, the priests, the prophets, and all the people seized him and said, you must die. Why do you prophesy in the Lord's name that this house shall be like Shiloh, and this city be desolate and deserted? And all the people crowded around Jeremiah in the house of the Lord. A little bit scary to stand up and preach like that. And then, do I dare to apply Jeremiah's message to us and still get out of here alive? I decided I'll take the chance because I have experienced the graciousness of La Crete Christian Fellowship. We have been reminded that the events of this book are not in chronological order, and so that's why we can skip from chapters 7 to 10 all the way to 26. The temple sermon in chapter 10 begins in a similar way to the shortened version in 26, and we'll read that in a little while. Jeremiah stands in the gate or in the courtyard of the Lord's house and proclaims bad news. The issue was religion in Israel. In the outline that we are following, Ernest Martin, who outlines this for us, calls this section Jeremiah's Critique of Religion in Israel. Jeremiah was called to criticize the religious practices and abuses among his people. That's a recurring theme among the Old Testament prophets. It's also a message that Jesus proclaimed in the New Testament. And that's also why we have that reading in Hebrews about the new covenant and the new high priest. But it makes us ask the question, is it also a message for us in 2018? and some questions that come out of this text. Is there a difference between religion and Christianity? And do we dare to feel a bit smug when we say we are not religious? And we'll touch on that at the end a little bit. Other questions that come to us out of this text are we perhaps guilty of wanting the church without really wanting Jesus? There's definitely movements in a push in some areas to say that we want Jesus, but we really don't need the institutional church. We just want to be followers of Jesus. But the church, with all its structures and also with all its problems, one of them was mentioned in our prayer time here. So let's just be followers of Jesus, but we don't need the church. That's the opposite of this message from Jeremiah, where we want the temple, but do we really want God? Today, might we say, do we want the church? But, you know, Jesus, following Jesus should make us a bit uncomfortable. Before we talk much about those questions, the historical details of this, I think, are important. I don't know whether you're getting tired of history from Jeremiah's time, but I think we need to understand the context of this sermon, the sermon by Jeremiah. The details actually are recorded in 2 Kings chapter 23, and that's an interesting read. 2 Kings 23, we won't read it now, but sit down sometime after Maddox Slope and read that section. After King Solomon, the kingdom had been divided into the northern kingdom, referred to as Israel, with its capital in Samaria, its worship center in Shiloh. And then there was the southern kingdom, Judah, with its capital and its worship center in Jerusalem. And so, yeah, that picture is kind of important. The northern kingdom, Samaria, the southern kingdom, Judah. And then in 722 BC, the northern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrian Empire under Tiglath-Pileser. And in 2 Kings, you can read about that in chapter 23 and following. The Assyrian Empire Emperor Tiglath-Pileser took the people from the northern kingdom into exile, scattered them, replaced Assyrian people into that area of Samaria. That left the southern kingdom of Judah still intact. In fact, when you read that history, it's interesting. Under King Ahaz of Judah, he even asked Assyria for help against in the fight against Israel. The infighting, it wasn't just enemies on the outside, but there were wars between Israel and Judah also taking place. We ask ourselves, has anything changed in the Middle East? Then just over 100 years later, in fact, those northern kingdom tribes, we sometimes refer to them as the 10 lost tribes. The southern kingdom was basically the tribes of Judah and Benjamin. Over 100 years later, the Babylonian Empire became the world power. Judah lasted for a while under the Babylonians, but only with a series of puppet kings. These kings they're recorded for us as kings, but really they were all subject to the superpowers, trying to survive by paying taxes and tributes to the powers, the bigger powers around them, and then forming alliances on either side. And so we read about Judah forming an alliance with Egypt to protect against the Babylonians. And then sometimes even forming an alliance with the Assyrians to the north, and it was back and forth. During this time, there were 8 successive kings of Judah, and we read about those 8 kings, and six of them, we read they did evil in the eyes of the Lord. It's a sad period. Only 2, it says, did right in the eyes of the Lord. Those 2 were Hezekiah and Josiah. 2 Kings 22 is where you can read some of that. It is in Josiah's time, really, that Jeremiah comes to the scene. But the pagan, idolatrous worship practices under the evil kings had been so established that the revival under Josiah, and we have that story, we know that story, when he read from the rediscovered book of the law, didn't bring a lasting change. He managed to centralize worship in Jerusalem by shutting down shrines elsewhere in the country, sometimes for political reasons. And with the climate, the political climate so volatile, the people more and more hung on to the belief that surely Yahweh the Lord would not allow Jerusalem to fall to an enemy nation. And this is where God lives, in the temple. Surely, as long as we have the temple, we will be safe. But the evil kings, starting with Manasseh, had so instituted all kinds of pagan worship practices that even after Josiah's revival, they quickly slipped back. The temple itself had idols shaped like beasts and monsters. We read about the use of wizards and sorcerers and cult prostitutes and barbaric rituals. Yeah, 2 Kings 21. Manasseh even sacrificed his own son in the temple. This man reigned for 55 years. That's a long time to have an evil king, and he had a big impact. When he died, his son Amon succeeded him, but the evil continued. He reigned for 2 years until his own officials conspired against him and assassinated him. And here is where 8-year-old Josiah, just 8 years old, was made king. I suspect that he had advisors around him, but in his innocence and in his uncorrupt spirit, God was able to direct him to bring some revival and some faithful worship. And I give credit today to Eugene Peterson, who writes a wonderful commentary, and so I've taken liberty to quote him and use many of his ideas in the rest of this sermon. He says it makes him think of a large expanse of the story of the evil practices that had taken root over these years, and then suddenly here we have a renewal or revival under Josiah. He says it makes him think of a large expanse of black asphalt over a parking lot. I say this with apologies to Knells and Sand and Gravel. There is no beauty in it. Some people see it as beautiful. Eugene Peterson just simply says, there's no beauty in it. The green grass or vegetation has been bulldozed away to make space for this monotonous surface. That's how he thinks about the practices of evil in the temple. But on this parking lot, this black expanse, before long, cracks appear and grasses and flowers push their way through. The underground forces of life break through the surface. Josiah represents this life force. Perhaps there were some old people remembering the former times of worship before Manasseh. Always when there are pushes to do away with true worship, I think There are hidden pockets of faithful people who push through the black asphalt of false worship. With Josiah, these people found renewed hope. Peterson says, a people's lives are only as good as their worship. A people's lives are only as good as their worship. For these people of Judah, all the lines of life crisscrossed in the temple. Meaning was established there. Values were created there. Worship defines life. He says further, if worship is corrupt, life will be corrupt. Josiah was determined to clean up the temple. In the process, the priest Hilkiah finds the old book of the law, probably Deuteronomy. This became then the guiding document for reform, a story about the love of God and worship of him. Clear directions of right and wrong, explicit directions on moral decisions. It was what Josiah needed to authorize his sweeping reforms. Under Manasseh, the temple had become a religious zoo. Religion had become a supernatural assistance to do whatever you wished. There is a way of taking God's name in vain when we couch some of our activities and our purposes under Christian. Supernatural assistance to do whatever you wished. Make money, ensure a good harvest, feel good, murder the person you hate, get ahead of your neighbor. Now under Josiah, religion centered in only one God. This temple at this point had idols all over the place. Idols to Baal, the Asherah. Josiah removed them all, and worship was focused on only one God. It became what it must be. And here Peterson gives us kind of a definition of religion. A discovering of the meaning of life, of ordering justice in society, of acquiring the discipline to live with integrity, of realizing how God loves and how we ought to love God in return. He would define that as the essence of religion. Now, about 5 years later, after this renewal by Josiah, Jeremiah is standing in the temple gate. 5 years. And people have slipped back. And we want to read the text from chapter 7 now. We better go 1 to 12. If we get the picture, things have happened. Renewal, revival. 5 years later, Jeremiah stands up in the temple, and here's what we read. This is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Stand at the gate of the Lord's house, and there proclaim this message. Hear the word of the Lord, all you people of Judah who come through these gates to worship the Lord. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Reform your ways and your actions, and I will let you live in this place. Do not trust in these deceptive words and say, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. If you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the alien, the fatherless, or the widow, and do not shed innocent blood in this place, if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, then I will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your forefathers forever and ever. But look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. Will you steal and murder, commit adultery and perjury, burn incense to Baal, and follow other gods you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house which bears my name and say, we are safe, safe to do all these detestable things? Has this house which bears my name become a den of robbers to you? But I have been watching, declares the Lord. Verse 12, go now to the place in Shiloh where I first made a dwelling for my name and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel. And so that's the message. Not a very popular one. In chapter 3, verse 2 already, Jeremiah has said, you have polluted the land with your vile harlotry. Peterson says, moral pollution works the same way as environmental pollution. The waste products of careless living work into the soil of thought and the streams of language, poisoning every part of society. Jeremiah's sermons become scathing, even a bit sarcastic. In chapter 4, verse 30, he says, what do you mean that you dress in scarlet, that you enlarge your eyes with paint? You adorn yourself in vain. In other words, outer cosmetics don't change the inside. The reform under Josiah had brought about good changes in the outward practices of worship. Superstitious religion was stopped. Immoral worship was banned. Idol worship, idols removed. And then I think we realize, and Peterson says this, but getting rid of evil does not make people good. Getting rid of evil does not make people good. It didn't take Jeremiah long to realize that the reform was only skin deep. The outward changes had been enormous, but inward changes were hardly noticeable. We would think that Jeremiah would at least congratulate the people on their better behavior, but we hear nothing like that. Everybody is coming to church to offer sacrifices as they are commanded to do in this newly discovered book of the law. Worship of the Lord is popular. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. And Jeremiah says, do not trust in these deceptive words. The people were standing in this holy place, chanting the right words, but their hearts were not right. The reform was necessary, but it was not enough. The practices that are part of religious observance are necessary, but not enough. True religion is a matter of doing, but it is also a matter of being, a matter of life and love, of mercy and obedience. When Jeremiah expected the people free from the corruption of Manasseh to be energized and venturing toward justice and peace, he finds the people I dare to read the way Peterson writes it. He finds the people stupidly pleased with themselves and repeating the slogan, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. And Jeremiah is not happy. Places are important. Buildings are where we gather ourselves for celebration and re-energizing. But standing in a church singing a hymn or a chorus doesn't make us holy any more than standing in a barn and neighing makes us a horse. I take that also from Peterson. Words are important. What we say expresses what is most personal and intimate in us, but mindlessly repeating holy words no more creates a relationship than saying, I love you 20 times a day makes us skilled lovers. These people were in the right place, saying the right thing, yet Jeremiah calls their presence and their words a lie. This sermon by Jeremiah is important to us. It is especially important in times of success when everything is going well, when the church has a respectable place in the community, when attendance numbers are growing, when statistics are impressive. The church is never in so much danger as when it is popular and millions of people are saying, I'm born again, born again, born again. I take those words from Peterson as well. But what does Jeremiah say in verse 11? Has this house which bears my name become a den of robbers to you, declares the Lord? A den of robbers, a place where you can hide after pillaging the weak and the unprotected. And we'll take a look at verses 5 to 8 just once more here, because this is what Jeremiah says. If you really change your ways and your actions and deal with each other justly, if you do not oppress the alien, the fatherless, or the widow, do not shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not follow other gods to your own harm, then I will let you live in this place, in the land I gave your forefathers forever and ever. But look, you are trusting in deceptive words that are worthless. We can spend all week in the world doing what we want, taking advantage of others, exploiting the weak. I think this is what Jeremiah is saying. And then come to this place where everything is in order and where our presence makes us look good. The words of other Old Testament prophets sound similar warnings. In Isaiah, he says, stop bringing meaningless offerings. In Amos, in fact, Amos is full of these kinds of statements. I despise your religious feasts, away with the noise of your songs. In Hosea, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. In 1 Samuel 15, to obey is better than sacrifice. Jesus, 650 years later, picks up the words, the den of robbers idea, in Matthew 21 and Mark 11, when he does some spring cleaning in the temple. Also in 2 Timothy 3, verse 5, Paul warns about holding the form of religion or godliness, but denying the power of it. James gives us a definition in chapter 1, verse 27. He says, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. Interesting definition there. If Jeremiah was speaking to churches today, if he was standing in the foyers of some mega churches, and you might want to Google mega churches and you will be amazed at how huge the churches are in America. Little empires almost. The Crystal Cathedral, Saddleback with Rick Warren, Willow Creek with Bill Hybels, North Point with Andy Stanley, and most of these churches have congregations of 20 to 30,000 people. Would he speak a similar message when he pointed out what had happened to Shiloh, the former worship center of Israel, now a pile of rocks? Would he mention that the Crystal Cathedral under the leadership of Robert Schuller went bankrupt and is in disrepute? Maybe he would quote Bill Hybels from Willow Creek in Chicago, who said during the years when that church was growing hugely in numbers, after that he said, we made a mistake. We were very good at bringing people in. We brought thousands of people in. We were not very good at making disciples. And lest we stop at these stories, perhaps we need to ask, what would Jeremiah say standing in our foyer? Would he congratulate us for being the second largest congregation in the EMC? Would he say, you must be doing some things right? I don't know, but I think his message needs to be something that we think about. I do want to say here, lest you think that I'm picking up Jeremiah's message and applying it in every way to us, that the experience, that my experience of the past year has been experience of support and care. And so, yeah, some of the things that Jeremiah accuses the people in Judah of cannot be said about La Crete Christian Fellowship. And so I think this is my opportunity to say thank you for being a caring, compassionate congregation. But we still need to ask ourselves some of the questions. What are the idols that we worship? Can a building become an idol? Can technology become an idol? Can programs become an idol? Yeah, we're glad when things are going well. We still need to remember that Jesus says, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall, individually, but also as a church. We live in a culture where image is everything, but what really matters is substance. A culture where a new beginning is far more attractive than a long follow through. Images are important, but Peterson says an image without substance is a lie. These temple sermons from Jeremiah should caution us always to look closely at the inside of our personal lives and the inside life of the church. I think it's okay to say that the people of Jeremiah's day wanted the temple without really wanting God. They really didn't want to follow what they already knew about living for God from the Old Testament, from the book of Deuteronomy. Is it possible that we may want the church without really wanting Jesus? Michael Iaconelli writes a book. In it, he shares that he started preaching at a church of about 250 people. And he preached Jesus. He preached what it meant to follow Jesus until he had that church preached down to 25 people. Following Jesus is serious stuff. So we ask that question. Do we want the church without wanting Jesus? I trust we want Jesus, even though following Jesus will make us possibly change the way we do things, the way we live. Is there a difference between religion and Christianity? Is Christianity maybe a religion? Maybe we shouldn't get hung up on semantics there. Maybe if someone says, I'm not religious, I'm a Christian, it's usually meant to be a negative comment about religion or being religious, as opposed to being a Christian. I think we need the practice of religion to be part of our Christian practice. There are structures, and church attendance is one of them, and church buildings is one of them, that we need in order to remind us and guide us in our following of Jesus. And so, to that question, I would simply say maybe it's not a matter of an either-or kind of issue. Let's not get hung up there, but let's keep our focus on what it means to follow Jesus rather than be guilty of the things that Jeremiah says about the people. This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. I close with a verse from Psalm 51, verses 16 and 17. A broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. I think that's where we need to meet God all the time. Amen.